You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and I will remind you before we get going that Praxis receives support from the Smith Barbieri Progressive Fund, a charitable foundation. Information at smith-barbieri.com. And today I'm really happy to be live in the studio with Sandy Williams. She is the editor and founder of Black Lens News, the former host of Revolutionary Spirituality, where longtime KYRSers may remember her from, recent Eastern Washington University Women and Gender Studies programs, activist in residence, and many more things. So we're going to talk about a little bit of all of that. Thanks for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, to be back. I guess you could just start by introducing yourself a little bit about how you came into both activism and journalism and art and who you are for people.
Okay, sure. How much time do you have? That's what I tell people.
Yeah.
let's see. Where do I start? So I came into activism, I think, by accident. I was frustrated with some things that were going on around me, and I had had some positive experiences when I was young where I had a teacher who showed me that I could write a persuasive essay and change things that happened in the school that I was in when I was in junior high school. And that kind of stuck with me. So when I had experiences that happened later in my life, I remembered that. And so decided that, you know, that sort of felt powerful to be able to have the opportunity to make a difference in the world. And so when those job opportunities opened up after I got out of college, I decided to sort of that was the area that kind of pulled me in. So I've done a lot of stuff. I've done activism with regards to racism. I had positions where I did HIV/AIDS prevention work, which involved activism around the LGBT community and folks who were HIV positive. I also have done a lot of stuff around class issues and it's hard to remember all of the stuff that I've done. I lived both in Spokane and in California. So I kind of go back and forth. In Spokane specifically, though, when I moved back here about 6-7 years ago, I did some work with Odyssey Youth Center. So that kind of brought me back into the LGBT community. And I also did suicide prevention, which was another form of activism. So it just seems like everything that I do sort of tends to revolve around activism. And then that led me out to the Pride Center out at EWU. And I was there for about 4.5 years. And there was another form of activism, which was within higher education and helping that be a safe environment and a supportive, nurturing environment for LGBT students. And I did that until June of last year. So there you go.
Yeah. And then so Black Lens is somewhere in the overlap there.
Yeah.
Because you launched your first issue was
January of 2015 was when I launched the first issue. And so for a while I did both. For 6 months in 2015, I did both the Black Lens and I did the Pride Center. And then June of last year, I just decided, you know what? I'm crazy.
Yeah.
I'm just going to dive in and see if I can just make this work because I really felt called to do that. And so since June, this is all I've been doing.
Yeah. And do you want to talk a little bit about how, so I have a big rant that I've been on forever in Spokane that a city this size to only have, you know, 2, 2.5, 3 newspapers is crazy. Mm-hmm. It's absurd. So I was so happy when I saw the Black Lens come out, and I'm especially happy that, you know, you're deep into volume 2 now. Mm-hmm. Doesn't look like it's going anywhere.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I hope not for your sake and for all of us. But what was the process there of getting it
to get started?
Yeah. And the motivation.
Yeah. Well, there was an African-American focused newspaper back in the 90s, which I was sort of vaguely aware of. It was called the African-American Voice, and publisher was Bob Lloyd, who's a friend of mine. And it lasted for a few years, and then it went away, and there hasn't been one since then. And so, you know, Spokane is basically my hometown. And so I know a lot of people here because I grew up here. And every time I would come to Spokane, there were conversations about the need for a black newspaper. There was need for the community to have a voice and a common place to talk about people and issues and, you know, a way for African-American people to be viewed as something other than negative. And so I've been hearing it, and particularly this last time that I came here, sort of the chorus was getting a little bit louder where we really need this, we really need this. So that was sort of in the background, and I had thought about it, but I knew it was going to be a huge undertaking, and I wasn't really sure that I was up for that. And but I have done radio, I've done film, I've done documentaries, I've done all different kinds of mediums, and I had never done radio or had never done a newspaper before. So I was curious, and that's sort of the beginning for me. And I've shared this with a lot of folks, but my dad was sick in 2014, and, you know, going towards the end of that year. And so I was spending a lot of time with him, and there was a lot of time just sort of sitting with him and me and my laptop. And so I thought, huh, I wonder if I could teach myself how to do InDesign while I'm sitting here with my dad. And I did. So I did. And that was, you know, I don't have a journalism background, so it's nothing like that. It was just, I wonder if I can do this or not, which is sort of the motivation for my life, I think. Mm-hmm. And I did. So I taught myself how to do the layout. And there were some stories that had come to the forefront. One of the particular ones in the first issue was the Use of Force Commission had published a report. And I was fairly irritated by the mainstream press coverage of the release of that report, and saying that there was no racial bias with regards to mm-hmm. that report. And I was pretty irritated by that. And so it just sort of came together. I'm sitting here. Why don't I just see if I can write a story about that while I'm learning how to do InDesign? And then the next thing you know, the paper started coming, and that was the first issue.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And I really like something I like about it, and I don't know if you can talk about like intention and how that's emerged, but it's really covers a lot of ground, you know? There's news, there's straightforward like local news, profiles of local black leaders and thinkers, and the one on Aaron Jones in this current issue that's out mm-hmm. that people can find all around Spokane mm-hmm. And at blacklensnews.com is it's really great, but then also, you know, looks at arts, looks at kind of national scope snippets of news. Why did you choose a format like that that covers so much ground?
So much stuff. Well, it's a monthly, mm-hmm. and so I wanted it to be something that would keep people's attention for a whole month. So that was part of it, but. When I was sitting down trying to figure out what did I want to put in it, I just started listing these are the topics that I'm interested in. And I remember telling my daughter, I was reading the list to my daughter, and she said, wow, that's a lot of stuff. And I said, yeah, it is a lot of stuff, but it's what I'm interested in. And I think part of it is that some people have a perception of the black community as being pretty monolithic. And so part of my intention was to show a variety of things. So there's spirituality, and there's business, and there's finance, and there's government, and there's politics, and there's, you know, just all kinds of stuff. So that was part of it. And then the other piece of the intention of it was for it to be a vehicle to educate the community, and for us to have an opportunity to learn things that we don't necessarily see or hear anyplace else. And I think that's the thing I'm the most proud of, is when people are constantly stopping me and saying that they learned something. You know, when I read it, I find out things that I didn't know. And that makes me happy, because I think that was the primary thing that I was hoping for when I put it together.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also just the urgency of that, too.
Yeah.
You know, I think racially right now at this moment that we're at, there's a lot of things a lot of people don't know.
That's true.
And if we can do it conversationally and invitationally and not in this, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's, you know, and so the local focus is important, because you don't typically hear about black people in this area unless they've done something bad. So if they break the law, you hear about them, but you don't hear about the success stories. And even in the black community, we don't necessarily hear about the success stories of each other. And so I So I try really hard, like I scan the community trying to find things that I can share about the positive things that we're doing, which we don't get to hear very much, and we certainly don't get to hear enough of that. So that's the local focus. But then I also think it's important for us to know what's going on outside of Spokane as well. So I subscribe to a couple of African-American focused wire services. So I didn't know there were any until I started this paper, and I stumbled onto them. And because there's national and international news that we also don't hear about. Mm-hmm. And so I try to find that kind of information out as well. And the news section in the paper is one section that's gotten bigger. So it used to be one page. Now it's two pages because people have been telling me that they really enjoy. I do sort of news snippets. Mm-hmm. And they're really enjoying that. And so, and I really enjoy that too. So, I think there's a hunger for information. And I think this is a vehicle for people to have an opportunity to find out what they don't know and maybe help them be more curious about looking for other things elsewhere too, I hope.
Yeah. And what do you think over this first year and a quarter of doing this, what are the stories that are continuing and growing that you're excited about, and maybe what was the most surprising story among those?
I think The parts that are growing for me that I'm really enjoying are the columns that are continuing. I have a couple that are every month. So Bertone does his art and history, and how that started was because I'm on a quest to find somebody to do either a comic strip or a political cartoon. So I've been after that for a year and a quarter now. But about, you know, a year ago, I was asking around, does anybody know any artists that do comic strips or cartoons? And Bertone was recommended to me. And so I talked to him, and he didn't want to do that, but he said he really liked history. So is it okay if I do a history column and I'll do art? And I thought, wow, that's really cool. So so that's grown really popular, really popular. And so he does that every month. And then Evelyn does I call it the grandma column. Mm-hmm. So thoughts from a grandmother. And that just started out from a conversation where, you know, why don't you just tell people what you think? And so that's become really popular. So it's been fun for me to watch people find their voice. I have other folks who contribute, not monthly, but every other month, where Ramel Watson does an opinion piece every 2 to 3 months. I love that. So that makes me feel good. The for people finding their opportunity to share things that they already were thinking about but didn't really feel empowered to do it. I'm working on young people, trying to find young folks who can have a column, a regular column, or will share things. Like in last month's issue, I had a young girl who's interested in art and graphics, and so I scanned in some of her art and presented that, which was really fun for me. Mm-hmm. So that's the
is
part.
Is that Jasmari Gordon?
That's Jasmari, right? Yeah. So I'm trying to get Jasmari to do a cartoon. I'm working on her. So Jasmari, if you're listening out there. Mm-hmm. but that's, so I enjoy that the most, finding people and giving them a platform. I think the thing that was the most surprising for me is that initially I thought it was just going to be sort of a feel good kind of, you know, let me just share some good stuff, feel good kind of paper. I didn't really anticipate how much of a need there was going to be to cover issues. And there's a desperate need to cover issues through a lens that's African-American focused. And in this community, there's a need for that. And I also get the most pushback from that. And I was kind of surprised, not surprised by the pushback, but surprised that that ended up being sort of a direction that the paper needed to take. And that's kind of taken on a life of its own. Yeah. So
where is that pushback primarily from?
Well, I won't say I'm surprised, but I can't tell you how many times people have asked, why do you need a black paper? Even recently, the Spokesman Review did an article on myself and the black lens. And if you look in, which I don't typically read comments, but a couple of my friends said, you should check out the comments, which I'm actually writing my column about. I do my own column every month. And so my column in the April paper is going to be actually about me reading the comments that came after that article. But But I can't tell you how many times I'm asked, why do you need a black paper? Like, that's so divisive, and it's so it's separating people. Can't we just all come together and stop talking about what's bad and all of that kind of stuff? So it's that kind of pushback. And so when I focus on an issue through a lens that's an African-American specific lens, I think that makes people uncomfortable because some of it's not positive. And quite frankly, in Spokane, we kind of like to pretend that there's no racism here. Spokane is full of good people who don't want to talk or feel about the stuff that's negative. And so sometimes the issues that are covered in the paper shine a light on things that I think people would prefer not to even know exist. So that's the pushback. Mm-hmm. And I'm not surprised by the pushback. I'm surprised at how big a need there was. And it shouldn't have been surprising, I guess, being this, there's been a vacuum with the paper for so long. But I think, like I said, I think it's taking on a life of its own, where that's becoming more and more needed in a way I had not anticipated.
Mm-hmm. I hope. I'd like to think. I mean, I know I live in kind of a bubble of people who do want to talk about that. But I just think we're at a moment where more people are curious and more people are, we're building kind of like this space where people, particularly white people who have never engaged mm-hmm. in talking about racism and want things to be nice.
Yeah.
And like peace as the absence of confrontation rather yes. than like peace with justice. Right.
Yes.
I think that is starting to crack open a tiny bit. So I think you've come on the scene at a really great moment.
Well, I think your generation too. Has a lot to do with it. I think it's a generational thing, and this is totally my opinion, but I think the younger generation is more comfortable being uncomfortable than the older generation just does not like to be uncomfortable. And just the existence of a black newspaper makes some people really uncomfortable. In fact, that's the headline of my column is "What's So Scary About a Black Newspaper?" Because justice, and these are sometimes people who've never even read it, so don't even know what's in there. But just the fact that it exists makes some people really uncomfortable. And I think that's the whole thing is I think we're sort of stuck in this place where some of us are stuck in this place where in order to get to the progress, you got to walk through the discomfort. And there's a lot of people that are for whatever reason, afraid to do that. Mm-hmm. But young people have a higher tolerance for that. I've discovered, I think.
We've been uncomfortable for a while now, so we're just kind of in it.
Sort of used to it, maybe.
Yeah. So if people have not yet seen The Black Lens, if mm-hmm. they're not subscribers, because people can subscribe.
Yeah.
I usually just pick it up downstairs at the community building when I'm coming through here. Yeah. But where else can people find it? How can people get involved, contact you, all of that?
So I have a website. I am kind of technologically... I won't say advanced because that's so not true, but I do have some technological prowess, and there is a website, blacklensnews.com. And if you go to the website, there are links at the top. One of the links is pickup locations. And so you can see the places that I drop it off around town, usually somewhere starting at the first of every month. And then that first week depends on how long it takes me to get around based on whatever else I have to do. But I hand deliver them. And that's been a really fun part of it, too, because I've had people offer to do some delivery for me. But that's a part of my outreach. And I've met so many people just in the process of delivering the paper every month that I don't want to let that go. So the drop off locations are there. And those have grown. I started out with just a handful of them. And I don't know how many are on there now, 20, 30. And people still asking. And so it's only limited by how many papers I print. Wow. Also on there is, so there's pickup locations, all the back issues are on there. There's a link that says past issues, and I put the PDF version of every issue is on the website. The current PDF of the paper is always on the front page, for people to read if they want to, totally free. And the subscriptions are for folks who just would prefer to have it come to them, and they don't feel like going out and hunting for it or driving anywhere to get it. I do subscriptions, and I just ask for the cost of postage for the subscriptions. And you can subscribe online, too. There's a tab on there where folks can just click the subscribe button, and it tells you how to subscribe.
Wow. And that's awesome that you're offering it for free. And so obviously it's advertisement.
Yeah, totally advertising.
Supported. Yeah.
And I wanted, you know, I made a choice because it's like you, because I'm not a nonprofit, I'm a business. And that was by design. I think it's important to model Black businesses in a community that doesn't have very many of them. So I'm a business, but I made a decision early on that it was more important for me to have people read it than to charge them for it. That's more important for me because I think the information is power, and I want to empower the community. And I figure that the money would take care of itself. Do what you love and the money will follow. That's sort of my mantra. So the advertising is sort of starting to grow. It's been a pleasant surprise. I told someone a couple months ago, I never ever imagined that this paper would take care of itself. I always believed I would have to find something else to cover the costs. I just believed that. And that's turning out to not be the case.
That's great. Yeah. I'm really happy to hear that. I'm especially happy to hear that in Spokane.
Yes.
So, yeah. I kind of want to... So, another question I always have for people who are journalists, and especially for you, because you're in this position kind of similar to the position I've been in, of coming out of doing activism and organizing and coming from the community into doing kind of a lot of citizen journalism. You're empowering a lot of people. Yeah. Who are just out living in these stories to write about them and share them. Do you consider journalism a form of activism?
Oh yeah, I do. I do. I did out at Eastern Washington University, EW, I did the Activist in Residence program out there, which I just wrapped up a couple of weeks ago. And the Activist in Residence program is through the Women and Gender Studies program at EW. And it's to bring real world activists to the students to sort of help them learn, come out of the textbooks and hear from people who've actually been doing it. And so I had the privilege of doing that this year, and it was a really, really great experience for me because it's one thing, I think activists sort of just do it. We don't think about how to teach somebody about what you do or explain to somebody what you do, which is sort of an interesting concept. And so it was interesting for me to kind of sit back and try to distill it down to something that I could communicate to somebody else. But great opportunity, great involvement. Had like 50 people showing up at the workshops. I did 4 workshops as well as some classes, and was a great opportunity. But I was sharing with them that one of the lessons that I learned a couple of years ago when I was really, really frustrated with activism work, really, really, really frustrated. Mm-hmm. My daughter was telling me I was really cranky. That a friend of mine said, you know, you're using your left brain too much and you need to spend more time focusing on your right brain. And so I coined this term right brain activism, which I'm sure I stole from somebody. But to be more focused on the creativity of it, the heart part of it, versus the left brain, which is more analytical and trying to convince somebody of something. And I had been focusing the majority of my attention for a long time, it feels like decades, on trying to convince people of what's right and what's wrong and what is racism and understanding the importance of all of that stuff. And instead of just feeling it. And so that's what I was working on, trying to just have people feel the experience instead of trying to lecture them on what is bias. I did activities where they got to experience bias, and it was great, received very well. So I believe that this particular paper, and I can't speak for all journalists about whether all journalists are activists or not, but for me, the Black lens is a form of activism in a lot of ways. Certainly has a social justice focus to it. Certainly is about change and creating change, which is my definition of activism, is that you see something that you feel needs change, and then you set about changing it. And this is certainly doing that. But it has the empowerment piece also, because I'm really committed to people, helping people find their own voice. I mean, I have mine too, but I'm really committed to helping this being a vehicle to help people find a voice. And I think that's activism as well. I think activism comes in all kinds of forms. And I think one of the things that shies people away from activism is we sort of have this stereotype of what it means to be an activist. You have to do X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And so if a person feels like I don't fit into that, then they feel like they can't be an activist. And what I was trying to communicate with the Activists in Residence program is that everybody can come up with some kind of way to make a change. And if it's writing, great. If it's singing, great. If it's, making a movie, great. If it's a radio show, great. My daughter's a fashion designer, and, you know, we've talked about ways she can use activism in fashion, that's her venue. So I think anybody can do it, and I think that makes it exciting and makes it a heart thing versus staying kind of stuck in our heads, mm-hmm. which I don't think heads actually change anybody anyway.
Yeah, the whole premise of this show when I started it 4 years ago was to figure out, because I was really frustrated with activism. Mm-hmm. It's good. Maybe we need to keep activism just frustrating enough to frustrate people to get them to have breakthroughs personally.
To do some creative stuff.
Yeah. So I wanted to see, what works. Yep. Let's talk to all these different kinds of people and find out what works. And now 4 years in, that's the most consistent answer that I've been getting. And it's also what I see the most evidence for is this. And you said right-brained activism in that workshop, which I was sitting in, and I just scribbled it down and totally freaked out and brought that to Pajels and brought it. Yeah. So right-brained activism is
good. I'm starting a movement.
Yeah.
See?
I'm going to give you credit on that.
But thank you.
Yeah. Cause a movement has to be more than people mm-hmm. being angry. That's the other, I think people's stereotype about activists is that it's one emotional state.
Yes.
And it's yelling at people.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a lot about you're wrong, I'm right, you're wrong. And so what I shared in the last workshop I did, which was a panel of people that are doing creative forms of activism, I shared a film that I made, which is called In the Land of Circles. And so I was creating a film to talk about the experience of coming out and how it felt to be a gay person who was oppressed and hurt from people on the outside. And so I could talk about homophobia. I can give a lecture on homophobia to people, or I could make a documentary about a little square living in a land of circles and what that feels like. And I tell you, when people watch that film, I don't have to say anything else because it goes straight for the heart, because all it is a story. And so I think that's the power of right brain activism. That's the power of creativity. That's the power of people connecting. You get past the hang-ups of language and thoughts, and you get to the heart. And I think that's where people actually change. So that's some of that I try to do in the paper, where I just try to share stories about people. What's really powerful about Erin Jones' story, which is in the March paper, which actually, once she told her story, I didn't know that I was going to write as much about her as I did until she shared her story. And then it was like, whoa, people mm-hmm. really need to hear this, because it was such a powerful story. And so so that's one of the things that I enjoy a lot, is having the opportunity to share stories. I think mm-hmm. that in and of itself does a lot. A lot of things that other types of activism or forms of activism can't do.
Mm-hmm. Her story is a perfect example of that because she, I want people to go out and read it, but to summarize, she grew up adopted by white parents in an interracial family, spending most of her childhood in the Netherlands. And then being able to come back to the U.S. and have an instant experience of this is a very deeply racist country.
Because I asked her, I said, what sort of started our long part of the conversation, because it was just going to be sort of a small highlight, because I had heard of her and several people said you should interview her. And so I was like, okay. So I was going to do a small highlight of her. And so the question I asked her was, you grew up in the Netherlands. So tell me, what was it like for you as a black woman to come back to the United States? And she said, how much time do you have? That was her response. And I said, as much as you need. And she started talking about the first experience. On the first day mm-hmm. that she was in this country, it was in her face. And there was something so powerful about that, because as a country, we want to pretend that it's not real. And so you have an example of somebody who got it that quickly. And it just validated experience. It validated my own personal experiences, but it has validated experiences for I don't know how many people who've read it, who've shared with me how powerful that was for them, because it validated their experiences too. So, so again, storytelling is just a really powerful venue, and nobody's lecturing, you know, mm-hmm. or anything. You just read it, and it's truth. It's her truth, but it reflects a broader truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't come back to her and say, no, you did not see a sign on a cricket field in 1989 that said no coloreds. You know, you can't. You can't say that the same way you can say you made up these statistics. Yeah, I think it's really powerful for that reason. I'm happy you're doing it. So what else? What was your experience like out at Eastern? Because I know the Activist in Residence program, it's from the Women and Gender Studies departments, mm-hmm. but it partners.
It
pretty
partners,
deeply, right?
With yeah, with Mecha partners with and Mecha, partners with, I don't even remember all of the partners, but I know partners with a lot of programs on campus, also with the Ethnic Studies program. So it was a wonderful experience for me. I loved, one of the things I love about college is that it's an environment where young people are opening their minds. To have, and they self-selected to come to this,
mm-hmm.
To the workshops anyway, not the classes, but to the workshops. And so you had a group of people who already knew what they were in for, who chose to come because they were interested in the subject matter, and then didn't just choose to come once, but many of them came all four times. So they were really engaged. They were interested. They were uncomfortable, and they shared that they were uncomfortable. And I kept encouraging them to put themselves in situations where they were uncomfortable. So, like, for example, I was doing talking about bias and the experience of bias. And so what I asked them to do, I said, we're going to do an activity. And what I asked them to do was pair up with somebody in the room that was like them in at least two or three categories. And they could not talk to the people in the room. So the only way that they could find out how somebody was like them, based on different identities, so whether it was race, gender, orientation, class, in national origin or whatever, the only way that you could know whether somebody was like you or not was to use your stereotyping or assumptions mm-hmm. that you're making or whatnot. You had to do that. And so hugely uncomfortable, because what people were trying to do is pretend that we don't do that all the time. But they were forced to. There's no other way. And so what became really interesting about that, after they sort of realized that they had to do it, whether they were right about their assumptions or wrong about their assumptions, and that became a wonderful conversation. And then what it did was it reduced the stress level for people, because I kept giving them permission to understand that everybody does it. Everybody does it. And so I get uncomfortable. For example, I went to a police forum this past weekend where one of the officers was saying that he doesn't see race, and race doesn't impact his decisions. And that's really scary for me, because you have a person who's not willing to acknowledge that, you know, of course you see race, and everybody has biases. We all do. I have them, and I teach people about them. So if I'm the person who's teaching about biases can acknowledge that I have them, everybody has them. And you can't start working on them unless you acknowledge that they're there. And so it was a real, I was proud of the students for putting themselves in the situation to be that uncomfortable. And what came out on the other end was just amazing conversation that we ended up having about what you can do with it once you're willing to acknowledge that you have them. So it was like that, you know, and each one of them sort of sequentially got a little bit more difficult and a little bit more difficult until by the end, I hope that they're able to carry that with them. And it gives them the ability to feel more comfortable interacting with people that they feel uncomfortable with or that are really different from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now at least they have those tools and
I hope so.
Yeah. I'm so glad to see that program's still going at Eastern because it shows kind of a, hopefully some of that knowledge will be institutionalized and once they have, they're equipped like that, then they can go to the institution and say, hey, there's all these ways that maybe you're failing as an institution, you know, as they all are in a variety of ways.
I think it's a powerful program. I was the third one. Liz Moore did it for 2 years. And what's important too about it is that activists are very different. You know, so and I think that's great, too, because people come at activism from different perspectives. And I think it's great for students to be able to see that. I was also invited to come out there as a part of the Activist in Residence program to talk to a media class. And we were talking about the role of media and racism in the media and why there is, in fact, a need for independent papers and particularly ethnic independent papers. And that was really fun, too. And that was sort of a bonus. I didn't know that I was going to get to do that.
Yeah, it's an interesting time. I was talking to Tracy Simmons about this a while ago, the editor of Spokane Faves. Faith and Values. And she's doing kind of a similar thing where some of it is bound to be activist content because of where she's positioned, you know, and where her writers are positioned in society. And I don't know, there's an idea in the academic world of journalism that it's all about objectivity and that it's possible to be 100% objective. It comes back to that bias idea that you just had, you know, and we end up, you know, saying, well, the truth is always right in the middle and you need to, you know, give equal time and equal air to a, you know, presidential candidate who will not be named, who's not serious, as you do to people who are bringing up serious societal issues. Mm-hmm. And I think that the internet's helped people push back against that, but also those independent people are just so important for that reason.
Yeah. Well, I don't make any bones about my papers not neutral. I don't try for it to be neutral, and I'm not going to pretend it's neutral. I do, if I feel there's a need to offer an alternative point of view, I'll do that, but I don't try to pretend that I agree with it. I think sometimes we do a disservice by pretending that trying to have an air of neutrality when I don't think it 100% exists. I took my background is film production, and one of the classes that I took was an editing class, and I watched this. One of the guest lectures was a master editor, and he showed us how he could take what looked like live footage and edit it down to say whatever he wanted it to say. Was just the most amazing thing I had seen. And so his premise was even documentaries, which we sort of assume are, you know, just sort of a neutral depiction of life, are not. They come by default with the point of view of the person who's making the film. So the documentary that I make is going to be different from the documentary that somebody else makes, even if it's truthful. So it's not saying that it's not truthful. And so that was really powerful. And so, you know, the reason there's a Black Lens newspaper is because looking at the same issue through a Black lens is going to be different from someone who looks at that issue through a different lens, because we all have biases. And so how I see something is going to be different from how somebody else sees it. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's negative. It means it's different. And I think acknowledging that that exists is really important. So I promote that. I want what I print in this paper to depict things through a Black lens. I think that's important.
Mm-hmm. And especially, I mean, that's part of what's frustrating trying to have, for me, someone who's trying to work on doing anti-racist organizing among white people, something that's really, or someone told me recently, people who believe that they are white, people who have bought into the idea of whiteness and that construct, talking about media as an example, you know, depictions of people in the media, it's when you're in this society and that's the stew that you're in. And then you have, when you look at the racial and gender and class breakdown of ownership of media outlets, mm-hmm. of course we're telling the same stories over and over again, you know? So
Yeah. It's like, for example, I did an issue in September that looked at education, and the entire paper was talking about education through a Black lens, through the African American lens, and that's one of the papers I'm the most proud of, because it was a really powerful issue, and I had young people tell stories, I had parents tell stories, I had former educators tell stories, but there's something about the commonality of their voices that students who were currently in school. I also had a student who was my age, so 50s, who had gone to school back, you know, 30 years ago, 35 years ago, and the similarity of his story to a young man who's in school now, in terms of talking about the racism in the school system. And so, it's important stuff. And I don't know that gets told unless there's an independent voice sort of jumping. I mean, I've always been the one in the room kind of raising my hand going, excuse me, excuse me,
yeah,
excuse me. And so this feels kind of like that too. It's just sort of another extension of that, me kind of on the side kind of going, excuse me, you're not talking about this, or excuse me, you're not talking about that. And I think there's an importance to that, because I think it reminds the powers that be. I mean, there's an accountability factor that, you know, we can't just all move forward, which is sort of the common theme. We're all just going to move forward. If we just stop talking about this stuff, mm-hmm. we'll just all move forward. And if that was going to happen, it would have happened already. Mm-hmm. It's not happening.
And forward to where?
That's right? True.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to. Just go forward if I don't know where we're going.
Yeah. That's true.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis. I'm talking with Sandy Williams, editor of The Black Lens and founder of The Black Lens Spokane. You can find at blacklensnews.com. Also, most recent activist in residence at Eastern, former host of Revolutionary Spirituality here on KYRS, which is one of my favorite shows here for a long time. And just talking about all of that, I'm curious, you said, you know, you're talking about how you've always been one of those people saying, excuse me. And we were talking before we got started on the air today about working in the gay community, in the LGBT community for all these years, you know, presumably since you've come out.
Yeah.
Which was in.
Ooh, now you're going to age me.
Sorry.
I came out. Well, it was after my daughter was born, and my daughter's 28, so it was that long ago.
Late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
So, and then you were working on those issues here and in California.
Yeah.
And then you worked again around the time that I would have met you in the mid, late 2000s. Mm-hmm. How has that changed, that world, and how does it intersect with
what I'm doing now?
Yeah, and with the racial equity work that you do.
That's a good question. So back in when I was doing HIV AIDS work, which would have been late 80s, early 90s here in Spokane, there was a core of us. It was a little scary, to be honest, because I was a part of the first Pride March that they had here. So it was scary just to be doing the Pride March, that first one. It was doubly scary because a couple of us who were people of color talked about when we got death threats, because we got death threats. So if they're aiming to shoot at the crowd and there's three people of color, who's the easiest target? You know, so it felt like there was sort of a heightened visibility. So it was already hard. And then there was sort of a heightened visibility that was difficult. There was also a core of us, so we were support for each other, which I appreciated. But I never felt completely connected to the mainstream LGBT community. So I wasn't connected to the mainstream Spokane community, wasn't really connected to the mainstream LGBT community, and wasn't connected to the African American community really, because I had this secret until I came out. So it was a challenging time, and I think probably part of the reason why I wanted to get out of here as fast as I could, mm-hmm. and stay away. So that was then. I'm older now. I think, again, part of the right brain activism thing, I think back in those days, it was really important to me that I that people understand. I was really committed to having people understand me and my story and all that. And at 54, I don't really care anymore. So there's something kind of liberating about that. But how have things changed? There's still racism in the community. That has not changed. That existed here. It also was very much evident in Los Angeles when I lived there. One of the big battles that happened was when Prop 8 passed in LA. There was sort of a backlash against the African-American community, the LGBT community versus the African-American community, because the LGBT community thought that the African-American community supported Prop 8. And then I was,
which was the anti-gay marriage,
which was the anti-gay marriage, which, and you know, one of the things that I was saying was, you know, I was talking about racism in the LGBT community long before Prop 8 ever came along, and talking about how you need to build bridges. And this was way before Prop 8 ever existed. And had that happened, had the LGBT community reached out to the African American community and the other ethnic communities prior to Prop 8, may not have been an issue. I don't know. But so that was frustrating and angering, and it still is. So part of what's challenging for me, and right now and continues to be, is that I don't know. The LGBT community is embedded within mainstream white culture. So the white LGBT community is fairly the same as mainstream white culture in terms of its view around race, which is we don't really want to deal with that, you know. And so that's frustrating. It's also frustrating for Black LGBT folks who see mainstream LGBT folks only sort of showing up when they need something. That's frustrating. So I have frustration with the community still. I don't think that that's changed. I think there's a lot of great stuff that's happened over the past however many decades it's been. Certainly a lot of doors that have opened. Certainly there's marriage equality, which is wonderful. And so there's a lot of things that are different, a lot more openness. As I worked at Odyssey, the young people were coming out earlier and earlier because they felt supported. People sort of discovering themselves at an earlier age. So there's a lot of that that's wonderful. I don't think that race has been dealt with. Still don't. And so for me personally, as a Black person, there's just so much stuff happening to Black people right now. And I just felt compelled to move in that direction. So it isn't that I'm denying my sexuality, or, you know, I'm not, that I don't love that part of myself, because I do, but they're just right now at this day and time in this country, there's just so much bad stuff happening to the Black community. Mm-hmm. And I just felt compelled to focus my attention there. So that's, you know, I don't know. I just, you know, I don't know. I think that's part of my crankiness, is that, you know, after you've been doing something for so many years, you sort of feel like there should be a little bit more movement than there is.
Mm-hmm. But I love that idea of, you know, focusing on where you're going to make progress. I mean, I think that's an activism tenet. It's hard when, you know, to feel, I can understand, I can empathize with the crankiness of having to kind of choose between these two parts of your identity. Mm-hmm. Neither of which are chosen, that are, you know, imposed on you by society.
Yeah.
So, I think that's good to hear. And it's been really impressive to see the speed of progress, like the generation just below mine.
Yeah.
I was talking with someone at Planned Parenthood who does education work in the high schools, and they used to do a segment on anti-gay bullying in high schools. And the last few times they've done it, the kids are like, why would you make fun of someone for being gay?
Yep.
Like, and that's, I've been out of high school 8 years, and that is a different world from then. So that's moving really quickly. So I think that focus on race is what's crucial, because people still don't get that. So.
Yeah. And it's fascinating that has moved as quickly as it has. And then, so then you kind of go, well, so what's up with the other stuff then? It's like, why is it possible for us to get that, fairly easy, but sort of the other part just doesn't seem to sink in. I don't know. And so, I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think there's a frustration level that I think that's rising. And I think you see that in the Black Lives Matter movement starting to happen. And I think there's a frustration level that I see amongst young folks, young people of color, who are sort of asking the question. It's like, yeah, we support these other issues too, but so what about us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is, taking the Black Lives Matter slogan and turning it into All Lives Matter. It's like, what's wrong with saying Black Lives Matter, which is the same thing as what's wrong with there being a newspaper that's called the Black Lens? You know, I've had people say, why don't you turn it into a multicultural paper? Like, why don't, you know, it's like, what's wrong with there being mm-hmm. something that focuses specifically on Black folks? And I think there's a really fundamental question in there that needs to be answered. And, you know, maybe that's what's going to start happening. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, I hope so.
I mean,
yeah, it's about time. I mean, last week I was talking with LaToya Brackett and Amanda Mansfield and Sherry Jones about the Spokane Now chapter. And we were talking about that history in the intersection of the civil rights movement, the Black liberation movement, really, beyond the civil rights movement and the women's liberation movement. Mm-hmm. And how during all that time, Black women were included for as long as they were needed and then told like later, yeah. later, later. And this seems to be, racially, at least, kind of a continuation of that.
Yeah.
And people
yeah.
really aren't having it anymore.
Not having it anymore. I think that's the best way to say it, is that, you know, people are sort of tired of feeling that. And I think there's some of that that's coming up in the election now, is that, you know, it feels like all of a sudden Black people become really popular during elections. And that gets a little old, you know.
Huh. Yeah. What was your take on, I mean, I saw you yesterday mm-hmm. at that, at the Sanders rally.
At the Sanders rally.
And there were, I mean, 10,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the biggest crowd I've ever seen in Spokane
yes.
for any reason.
Yes. It was amazing. It was my first big event where I got to be in the press corps. And that was really cool. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I had my chest poked out a little bit, and I got to wear my press badge. And I haven't even had a chance to create my Black Lens press badge, which I'm in the process of doing. But I got the Bernie Sanders press badge, which was really cool, which I'm saving.
Yeah.
But what was my take on that? It was amazing. I mean, it was amazing to see that many people turn out. There was a diversity in the crowd that, to be honest, was absent from, because I went to the Clinton one today as well. And to be honest, there was a diversity in the crowd yesterday that was absent today. That may have been because of timing. So this one was in the middle of the day and people have to work. And so I don't know what the reason for that was. But, you know, as somebody who's looking through a Black lens, that's what I'm looking for. You know, words are nice, but I'm looking to see who's showing up. So that was interesting, but it was wonderful to see all the young people. It was wonderful to see the enthusiasm. I hearken back to my daughter when in 2008, when Obama was running for president, and how excited she and her generation were. At that time, I remember that, and I was so excited because I had been trying so hard to get her interested in politics, and because I've been doing that, you know, since I was young, and she just never was until Obama came on the scene. And then all of a sudden they were having political debates and political conversations. It was like, wow. And it felt like that again, that vibe and that energy, and where young people were sort of showing up. And so that part was fun and exciting. And so I'm going to write about them both. I went to both of them, and I'm going to write my take on both of them. Will be in next month's issue.
Great. I look forward to reading it. I was just kind of riding my bike along that line, because at first I came back around 4 p.m. and I thought, this isn't 2,000 people. What are they talking about? I was reading Nick Deshaies' tweets from the spokesman. I was like, this isn't 2,000 people, because I was right next to the convention center on the south side of the river.
Mm-hmm.
So I biked around, and then I went and I parked my bike. I went into the mall to go to the bathroom. And when I came out, I saw the line on the north side of the river all the way to City Hall.
Yes.
And I realized, that's the line.
Yeah.
Like, that was just mind-blowing. And then I rode along the line, and it was the most diverse, and again, I'm in a bubble of relatively high ethnic, age, mm-hmm. gender, sexuality, diversity bubble, than most of Spokane mm-hmm. because of being involved in activism. Like, that's who's involved in activism, people who are directly involved. But just going through there, I mean, it was an incredibly diverse mm-hmm. group of people in age and every other visible marker, and that made me really happy to see. So
yeah, I'm excited for the excitement. I think that's mm-hmm. what it is, because the second Obama election, I felt the energy drop, and people were disenchanted and felt disenfranchised, and so I'm excited to see excitement again, for whichever side. I'm just excited that people feel like they're waking up again and getting excited, and that's what's important to me. So mm-hmm. That was a good thing.
Yeah. What's your take? I mean, I'm pretty cynical about electoral stuff myself, and it comes from that. I have no trust mm-hmm. at this point, but I'd love to see that. I'm excited about the excitement, exactly yeah. as you said. What do you think is our best? How do you think we can call a lot of those people who are excited about Bernie Sanders right now, excited about the issues he's talking about, and turn them into like movement people, you know, all the time? Yeah. Movement people.
I think that's the hard part. I think that's the really challenging and hard part. Because I've always said, you know, if we as Americans did what we were supposed to do, it wouldn't really make any difference who was in office. I mean, if we really did what we need to do, and we don't, we sort of it's sort of like a sporting event to get them in there, and then we kind of go back to whatever we were doing. And I think that's a big part of the problem. But I don't have an answer for that, because I don't know how. Because you know, I think that's part of why activism work is so challenging, is because there's usually a small number of people that are engaged, and we kill ourselves because we are doing everything. It's never a large number of people. It's rarely a large number of people. And you know, I think that's the $10 billion question. How do you get more people to be engaged at the same level that the core activist people are? I don't know. Most people don't do that unless they feel directly threatened. And so how do you get more people to feel like this is big enough? What's happening in this country is big enough that it is directly threatening. I don't know. That's something I hope to explore, because one of the questions that I'm looking at as the political season comes up with the Black Lens is looking at, you know, the African-American community has been traditionally Democratic. Don't make no difference what Democrats do. We just sort of in lockstep fall behind them. And I think there's some critical questions that need to be asked about why that is and what are we getting from it. Mm-hmm. And so how do you get people to look at things a different way and then actually step up and do something about it? If we're going to support them, then how do you then hold them accountable for what they need to be doing in return? Should be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that you inflated the number. We're not talking about $64,000 questions anymore. We're talking about
no
bigger numbers.
Big.
Just in our last couple minutes that we have, what else do you want people to know? What do you want to put out there?
It's a fun time for me. I think that's what I would want people to know, is I would encourage people to find something that you're passionate about and do it. You know, people ask me about did I have a journalism degree? Nope. You know, did I have any experience in journalism whatsoever before I did this paper? Not at all. Nothing. Zero. I don't know what's the traditional journalism way you're supposed to be putting stories together. I don't know what's appropriate. I don't know any of that stuff. And I'm sure I'm doing it all wrong, and it doesn't really matter. And so I would encourage people to do just sort of dive in there and find the creative or the uncreative or the passionate thing that moves them so that they can change something in the world. Because I think that's what is needed, and that's in a lot of cases what is missing. And what I get back in return is just been amazing. I'm grateful for the support that I've gotten. The community has rallied around me in a way that I didn't expect or imagine, and that's been wonderful. You put it out there and see what happens, and you know, what comes back is something that can change things, and I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm glad you came and talked to me. I've been meaning to have you on for a long time.
Thank you.
As we discussed, and Women's History Month, you know, I'm trying to feature people who are doing that and who are telling other people's stories and getting it done. So again, I've been talking to Sandy Williams, editor of the Black Lens News, which you can find at www.blacklensnews.com. Also on Facebook.
Yeah,
and
we're on Facebook, and I'm not a Facebook person, so I think it's Black Lens News.
It is, and okay. I link to it here. So if you go to facebook.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO, there's a link on there. I'll link to the podcast when it up later today. Yeah, but I'm just really happy that you're doing so well with this and that you're happy.
Yeah, you know? I'm happy.
That's what's important. Activists can be happy.
Yes, we can.
We can be satisfied in our work. That's something I want to leave people on, too. So
yes, use the right brain. It makes you happy.
Good. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
There's a lot more we could say, but we're out of time, as always. So thank you all for listening. If you have questions, if you want to get in touch with Sandy about doing political cartoons was a need, about telling stories,
yes.
Contributing, subscribing, all of that, I can put you in touch through my email, where you can also send me story ideas and all that, praxis@kyrs.org. So
thank you. It was great to be here.
Yeah. Thanks for being here, Sandy.
Take care.
And thank you all for listening. I'll be back next week, hoping to record an interview with Loretta Ross, who keynote spoke at International Women's Day this weekend about reproductive justice. She was amazing. Stay tuned for more details about that. I'll be back next week. You're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.